When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to I'm Absolutely Fine, the podcast from The Midult that looks at all the glamour and indignity of being a grown-up.
Hi everyone, I'm Emily and I'm absolutely fine, but this week I'm on my own. Yes, Annabelle is out of office, but don't worry, you do not have to listen to me prattling on solo. Instead, I have two podcasts from last year, interviews with the brilliant entrepreneurial women that are Sahar Hashimi, who founded Coffee Republic, and Joanna Jensen, who founded Child's Farm. So sit back, relax, ha ha ha, and enjoy these tales from the entrepreneurial front line. Bye.
Hello, everybody. I'm Annabelle, and I'm absolutely fine, but this is neither a noble nor a courageous problem to have. But I have become increasingly and genuinely scared of my grater. I'll do almost anything to avoid grating. Like, I developed over Christmas and New Year a sort of passion for ginger tea. And I don't mean like ginger tea bags. I mean like fiery. The way to make ginger tea is to grate the ginger and then put it on a rolling boil. Don't want it to infuse. A rolling, vicious boil for 5 minutes on the stove. But I don't want to grate the ginger. So I sort of put it on a vicious roll, but it's great big chunks. It doesn't have the same effect. I buy ready grated cheese. I'll do almost, you know, whenever it says, you know, grate your carrot. No, I'd really rather not.
There is something really like scary about that moment when you feel like you might actually just take the skin off your hand.
And it will be a knuckle.
Yes.
And I used to be braver and I used to get the cheese down to a nub. And now if I do grate cheese, I mean, I when there's still a great brick of it left, no, my knuckles must go nowhere near that weapon of mass destruction, that instrument of torture.
I often think when I'm grating cheese that there must be a better way, but there you go.
Answers on a postcard, please.
Yes, exactly. Is there a better way? Well, hi, I'm Emily. I'm absolutely fine. But it turns out I'm addicted to caffeine.
It does,
not only,
it?
Not only that, but I'm also incompetent without it.
Yes, it does turn out that you are.
So the other day I had to do blood tests and so therefore I had to not drink any tea for 24 hours.
We should say at this point that Emily isn't allowed coffee.
Yes, yes.
She once had a cup of coffee before a meeting that we were both in, probably 20 years ago, and was instructed never to drink coffee again. Yeah. We talk about swivel-eyed loon.
No, it makes me crazy. Anyway, tea has been my crutch. And
Many teas.
And so I didn't buy about 11 o'clock. It was like I had no bones.
I thought you were coming down with it. I couldn't work out your eyes had gone cloudy, all the colour had drained from your face. And also, it was one of those really strange occasions. I'd slept the night before.
Yeah, so you were, like, turbocharged, high-powered, as I slumped more and more and more, feeling more useless and incompetent than normal. And it was just, it was an absolute nightmare.
I mean, you had to knock off early.
I had to knock off early. I fell asleep fully clothed on the sofa at 5 and then again at 8 o'clock. And I was like, what is going on? And then I realised that it was because I hadn't drunk any tea. Anyway, I was never been more grateful to take my Yorkshire tea bag.
You see, a lot of people would take that as information that they should stop drinking tea. I'm so glad that you dived back into it. It's genuinely your only vice.
I was so traumatised by how unbelievably useless I was.
Is tea a vice?
Well, please.
Pathetic how small our rock and roll lives have become.
Anyway, regular listeners will know that we often slip the patriarchy into the conversation around what holds us back. From diet culture keeping us hungry while feeding our self-loathing, to medical misogyny, to the tensile pressure on heavy office doors that are only stress-tested by big burly builders and therefore really hard for our lady arms. So it's a privilege, really, to introduce our next guest, who has smashed through many a ceiling and is still busy opening lots of doors for women. Sahar Hashimi brought coffee as we know it to the UK in 1995 when she founded Coffee Republic, 3 years before Starbucks landed on our shores. And within 5 years, they went from zero coffee shops to 110. Now, for the past couple of years, she's been putting her considerable energy into spotlighting women-owned businesses with her Buy Women Built movement, asking the question, why do we only hear about the men? Did you know that a staggering 81% of 11 to 18-year-olds are unable to name one single female entrepreneur? She's out to change all that. We are thrilled to have her here. Sahar, how are you?
Well, hello, Annabelle and Emily. I'm absolutely fine. But I don't know what is wrong with me, but I just wake up with literally I'm not grinding my teeth, but just really clenching my teeth when I wake up in the morning. And it's almost just looks insane. I don't know what I'm doing at night to just wake up. Literally, they're attached to each other, my teeth.
Lockjaw.
Locked. My teeth are locked together. And I've just been researching it all weekend, thinking there must be a solution. And there was apparently you can Botox your masseter, which is that big muscle. And I'm really scared to actually Botox my jaw in case I can't speak. But apparently even dentists do it. So I'm about to, after this, go and find a dentist that will Botox my jaw.
Any excuse for more Botox, right?
Do you have to prise your mouth open, morning.
I swear to God, I wake up and I can't even imagine. It's like the sort of Tom and Jerry, electrocuted. As if I'd been electrocuted exactly. At night, I don't know what that is. I wish there was a muscle relaxant I could take when I sleep. I don't know what it is, really.
Well, I believe there are, but I don't know if we should go down that path.
I was thinking, about Michael Jackson taking propofol at night to sleep. I'm just virtue of being anaesthetized every night.
There's your future.
Exactly.
Let's rewind a bit and talk about your past. So it's the early 90s. You're a lawyer. And what happened? Did you just go to New York and have a cup of coffee?
I was a lawyer and I'd been working for 5 years and increasingly a sort of unhappy lawyer. I loved the training and stuff, but once I qualified, I sort of felt really unhappy kind of going to the city every day. And to be honest, I could feel everyone else was sort of shining and doing really well and thriving, the people I started with. And I could feel I was sort of slipping behind. And I just wasn't enjoying it. I think I was doing a pretty crap job at it. So there was this sort of discontent, literally, sitting over me in the career I'd chosen. Exactly. And then it was this one trip I went to visit my brother Bobby in New York and woke up with jet lag and literally came across skinny lattes for the first time in my life. I sort of couldn't believe I was given an option of what kind of milk to have in my latte.
Because here it was really, when I was a kid, it was Nescafe, it was Builder's Coffee, or it was terrifying espresso.
Exactly, yeah. Or you'd sort of go to a sort of sandwich bar and then they just give you this sort of, you remind me, this horrible coffee in those polystyrene cups.
Yeah.
So really sort of horrible experience. Or the office coffee machine, often you guys remember. Exactly, that was
what
I was
sort of... Yes, with the filters and the great big thing. And that always made you feel sick.
Yeah,
you'd have no breakfast and drink 4 cups of that and then wonder why you felt insane.
I know, I remember doing work experience or being interns at that point, learning how to make the coffee machine work was sort of the most important thing, that and the fax machine.
Yeah. And do you remember that all offices smelt of that coffee?
Yes, they did.
You knew you were in a corporate environment because that was the kind of tell.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And it was always burnt coffee, that sort of awful smell. And I really fell in love with this. And they had these wonderful sort of muffins and biscotti jars.
So the ritual around it as well. So not just the coffee, but the sort of idea that you could have treats.
Exactly. And it was actually the idea that you could leave the house in the morning and start your morning in this buzzy place all about coffee, which we didn't really have. So, you could smell the coffee machine. You could smell the coffee grinding. You could hear the coffee machine. Everyone's getting their coffee. We used to have sort of sandwich bars. Nowhere, in that Italian sense of coffee. But, I saw it in New York for the first time.
And also in London. God forbid someone should be nice to you before 10 a.m. Someone would smile and say, what would I like, rather than throwing some boiling liquid at you.
Also, we were definitely fetishizing coffee anyway, weren't we? Because we had those sort of Nescafe ads where hey, would you like to come over for a coffee? So
yes, exactly.
We were very much coffee's in our home, but not outside.
Yeah, I remember the phrase. It was that Nescafe Gold Blend sex ad? Will they, won't they?
Oh, that's right.
And she used to go, lovely coffee.
And also, don't remember that Friends was sort of starting at that time. And do you remember
Central Perk.
Exactly. Central Perk, and they got together in Central Perk, and that was almost the kind of genesis of the coffee bars, because they sort of invented that really before even the American coffee bar concept started.
Yes.
Hanging out in Central Perk.
Yeah, yeah. And there was sex in there, wasn't there? If you want to sell, you use sex, and that was all about, do you remember Gunther?
Yes.
Goodness me.
Just following Rachel around.
So, okay, but what sort of person who's just a sort of young, slightly unhappy lawyer thinks, that was a nice experience. I'm now going to take this entire experience across the Atlantic.
Yeah, I'm a sad solicitor. Here, I'm going to build an empire.
I remember just getting back to London and I was sitting with my mum and my brother Bobby in a Thai restaurant off the King's Road. And I just remember very casually saying to them, oh God, you know, back at home now. I was actually looking for an in-house job at that time. So I was going for interviews and I was like, I can't believe we haven't got those American style coffee bars. I wish I could leave the house every morning and I'm not stuck at home with the sort of last slice of washing up, making myself Nescafe with boiling water. I wish we had those American coffee bars. Like, I really miss going somewhere in the morning, leaving the house and having a ritual. And that's where actually Bobby, my brother, got the old light bulb. And, you know, he'd heard about Starbucks and he said this, and I can't believe you've said this. This is a great concept. We should bring it over. And to be honest, I was having none of it because I kind of thought I was a consumer. So I couldn't understand why I had to provide a solution to my own problem. So, you know, for me, like, you know, other people open coffee bars, right? Like, you never have to, like, scratch your own itch. I never thought that is the kind of beginning of an entrepreneurial journey, scratching your own itch. So I wasn't having none of it because I was like, I'm going to wait for other people who open coffee bars, that whole sort of tribe out there, to do it. It's not me, you know. But anyway, Bobby was having none of it and he basically paid me to do research for 1 week. And I literally got a check from him. Because you guys might be too young to remember, but we used to carry our checkbooks around with us everywhere.
No.
And I basically took a check off him to do 1 week's research because I was actually had no intention of starting a business. I was actually insulted.
And also, it's because it's your brother. You're like, you're such an idiot. Fine, pay me.
Exactly. Literally, pay me. And that's like my
sibling
hourly
economics.
Rate as a lawyer. Exactly. He very much, which is what I wrote in my book, Anyone Can Do It, sort of guided me through every step. So it was like, okay, you know, go and do research for a day. And I got on the Circle Line and my research was sort of getting off at every single of the stops on the Circle Line to see what there was. And I came home that night and I was like, ooh, there doesn't seem to be anything like it. And it literally taking it kind of one day at a time, sort of now realizing with that sort of mindfulness journey, not thinking I'm going to do this, just like, okay, today's fine, tomorrow. And, you know, I didn't have a job then, so it was occupying me. And next thing you know, you sort of do one day at a time until you look back and you're like, oh, I'm kind of quite a long way along this journey.
This is an advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online.
Now, you guys know that we're not shy about getting things off our chest.
The tiny inconveniences that can ruin our days to the big, overwhelming worries that can flood our nights. Trouble is, we all got into the habit of saying, I'm absolutely fine. Emily and I added the but specifically to get off autopilot and give ourselves the space to say what we were really experiencing.
But we weren't always so free with our inner furies. A few years ago, I began experiencing debilitating panic attacks because I felt I couldn't tell anyone all the things that I was feeling, that I was not coping, that I felt like a failure. I was so ashamed, so I kept it all bottled inside. And of course, it started leaking out. It was only when I found a therapist and began sharing those doubts and insecurities with her that the panic began to dissipate.
Because therapy can be a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try?
It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise. And our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/midult. That's better, HELP.com/midult.
BetterHelp, because sometimes the best thing to do is acknowledge that we are not, in fact, absolutely fine.
It's interesting that, isn't it, that you don't have to start it. I think one of the reasons people don't start, I think, is because they think they're meant to start every project with a vision for world domination. But you're saying that that is not at all what happened.
Absolutely. And like, funny enough, you know, one of the observations I was thinking in bed this morning, that actually dreaming big is one of the worst pieces of advice you can give to a young person, to dream big, because it's sort of when you dream big, it's like too big to even start. And you're almost like paralyzed by the kind of sheer scale of what you need to do. And then you sort of not do it, just thinking it's a dream. And that's so, you know, whereas I would just say don't overthink, just start doing something, anything. And then eventually the path kind of finds itself. And that's what we did. I didn't think too much about it. I was just putting one step in front of the other the next day, you know, do market research. And then, you know, thought this makes sense. I went back to New York to the same coffee bar before Google days took pictures of that, made a little album, you know, came back and sort of, I remember people kept saying to us, it's crazy, like, you're opening a coffee bar, you don't even know anything about coffee. And they were like, people always trying to poke holes, right, when you start something. Mm. And they're always trying to kind of almost tell you why you shouldn't. And they were like, you don't know the difference between Java and Sumatra coffee. Like, what the hell are you doing? You're not a coffee specialist. Why would you open a coffee bar?
Because the sad solicitor on her way to work in the morning doesn't either. She just knows that this is making her day better.
Exactly, absolutely. And sort of, and so, you know, but I remember thinking, just to shut them up, Lavazza had a free training course. I remember Bobby and I went on it thinking we might learn something. And in their training course, they were going to learn. And I remember we were so excited to learn that it was a kind of coffee training course, coffee tasting. And we ended up having 26 espressos between the hours of 9 and 11. I swear, I didn't realize you sort of spit it out. You don't drink when you're on a tasting. Like, the whole thing is to sort of swirl it around your mouth and kind of spit it. And we drank it, and I remember it was in Chiswick, and we stopped off on the way back on the A4 at the petrol station. And I remember I said, but I need to buy 2 Mars bars. I remember I just like had thinking this is going to like somehow absorb the caffeine that's going through my system.
And your first shop, I think, was in South Moulton Street, right?
Absolutely.
Posh, pedestrianised, loads and loads of human traffic. I mean, how soon after you opened it did you think this might work?
Not for a while, actually, to be honest. Again, you know, it's sort of, you know, the whole idea we have of overnight success, like, you know, now I think there are 22,000 coffee bars like that. We were the first to open. So people always think, you know, people put too much pressure on themselves. So people think, oh, I just opened it and it's going to be a roaring success. I mean, no one came in. So, you know, when I say no one came in, I always say our break-even sales were 700 quid. So we had to make 700 pounds of sales a day to break even. And every single day we're making literally like just under 200 pounds. And when I say 200 pounds, I'm discounting my poor mum who's coming in drinking as many cappuccinos as the poor thing could. She'd bring her friends, they'd all have cappuccinos. But still, you know, no one was coming in. So, you know, new things are always met with like rejection, and we forget that, you know. So people didn't like coffee bars at the beginning. They were literally going to the sandwich bar next door, getting a polystyrene coffee. And we did everything. I remember the first fashion week, kind of I went there, took a coffee machine. I was making all this kind of like cinnamon lattes and vanilla, you know, cappuccinos for all the sort of fashion editors, try to get people's interest. But, you know, people really are resistant to change, I think. And sometimes, you know, we think it's got to be immediate, whereas, you know, new things are always rejected by consumers more than anyone else.
And then what happens?
In a funny way, like, I wasn't even thinking of that because I was just so convinced that I wanted it myself, which is why my whole premise is, you know, you shouldn't start a business unless you're its own first customer. It's a bit like that kind of, you know, the Victor Kiam Remington, whatever it was, you know, I love the company so much. You know, I love the product so much I bought the company. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was convinced in a way. So I wasn't really going to give up. But, you know, that persistence really, it's just best not to think about it. Yet again, not to navel gaze and say, you know, is this a success? Again, as women as well, you know, we sort of, there's too much conversation going on in our heads. And if we let that take over, you know, am I doing the right thing? Am I on the right path? You know, literally, my only solution to life is just not to think too much, just to sort of do. So again, one step after the other, you know, we tried everything to try to get people to come in. You know, we did like, you know, promotions with Gap. We did delivery, which was a nightmare, doing coffee delivery. Could you imagine? I remember, like, you know, literally someone would want us 14, you know, grande lattes. And then you've got this tiny store and there are people queuing up. You're trying to make 14 grande lattes off one machine to deliver before it gets cold. Nightmare. But, you know, you just try a million things until eventually, I remember, we opened one more store in Great Marlborough Street. I remember when we had 2 stores thinking, wow, it's so exciting. We're like a big chain now. You know, which one do I go to? And then slowly people step saying, you know, kind of, you know, sort of. And then I remember we opened Fleet Street where Goldman Sachs and everyone was. And there were like queues around the corner. And that was an amazing feeling. That was like an amazing feeling. Actually, I remember that.
And I remember you became a kind of thing. Yeah. You know, we worked on the magazines. You were in the magazines.
Absolutely.
People really, you know, gave a shit.
The reason why, you know, I very much put my own story forward was I remember thinking, I was hearing Starbucks was about to come. And I remember speaking to PR people and they were like, yeah, well, it's difficult to kind of talk about brands, saying why Coffee Republic's better than Starbucks. And then suddenly we sort of figured that actually, if me and Bobby, especially the brother and sister story, people will always remember that. They might not remember the company, but they remember the people and the story behind it and their passion. You know, that's what kind of stays with people for a long time. So we sort of put ourselves, and me especially, as the face of the company forward. And it was great fun doing it, thanks to you lot.
Yes. And then why did you decide to step away from Coffee Republic? What was the moment when you thought, you know, you have 110 shops? Yeah. Why did you decide that you were going to move on?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the biggest mistake in a way, because it all happened so quickly. You know, we were quite young, you know, and it was all really propelled. Like, my dad had died, and that was suddenly that perspective shifter whereby, and that's really when I kind of really decided to leave the law firm and think, do you know what, life's too short. I've got to do something I absolutely love doing. And then, like, within 5 years, really, my dad died in 93. We opened Coffee Republic in 95. And really by 2000, the year 2000, we'd grown from, like, my mum's kitchen table to 110 stores. And suddenly the company started becoming really corporate. You know, we got all these people from big companies coming in. I remember we had the managing director of Pret, someone from Disney. And the feeling they gave you, which, again, I think slightly women feel that more, is, oh, you know, well done, little girl. You started the company. That was really great. You know, your whole enthusiasm and your passion. That's really lovely to start. Oh, good for you. But now, you know, give it to the big boys. You know, give it to the grown-ups. You can't run big companies the way you do with passion, going around store to store. You know, passion's not enough. And I very much believed in that at that time. And the company sort of changed character. I sort of felt like it wasn't the same, you know, whereby when we first opened, we were like up there with everyone, with the whole team was so entrepreneurial. Everyone's like, you know, putting the posters up, getting it all ready. It became more corporate, much more depersonalized. And I just felt really alienated from it. It was really bizarre. And the sort of feeling was, oh, you have a sell-by date, you know, entrepreneurs sell. And it was came the same time as a dot-com boom. And we sort of fell for that, you know, people were selling and people were like, companies were valued at something. And when's your exit? And it was so wrong. We fell for that. And it was so wrong. And it was such a big mistake. And I felt absolutely terrible afterwards.
Oh, you regretted it. Do you still regret it?
Yeah, enormously, Annabelle. Yeah, absolutely. Which is why sort of, I mean, the books I've written and the kind of consultancy I do to big companies around how to keep that startup mindset. Because, you know, for entrepreneurs, you know, what you do in a way is like a creative expression of what you do. So suddenly selling your company, I mean, they say, I've studied it a lot now, and they say it's very much like a bereavement because you just really love what you do. And I just remember, I was so, I can't tell you the emptiness I felt at that time when I sold. I remember going past it, actually going to a party with a friend, and we went past Coffee Republic on High Street Ken, and I said, oh, look at Coffee Republic. And he said to me in the taxi, oh, it's got nothing to do with you. Don't look at it anymore. And it was literally like a dagger in my heart. But no one talked about that sort of thing back then. Now, you know, lots of entrepreneurs get together. There's a whole network. People talk about how painful that is. But no one did. So it was slightly sort of suffering this by myself, not realizing, but it was incredibly painful. And seeing the company, you know, after we left, I remember I'd still go to the stores because I loved it. And we gave it to these kind of corporate managers to run, and they just took it to the ground, really. I mean, 8 years after we left, I remember sitting writing my second book, and I remember hearing Coffee Republic had gone into administration 8 years afterwards. And it was just, I mean, it's like your baby, you know. Mm.
What happened to make you in 2020 want to launch a whole new initiative? Obviously a very different kind of, I don't know if one would even call it a business, maybe one calls it a movement, but by women built. Did you feel that women founders and women entrepreneurs weren't getting recognition? Was it about giving us a choice to spend our money on women-made products? What was it that got you thinking about putting these brands, these female-founded, female-run brands, into the spotlight?
Well, I'll just go back a kind of tiny steps on that. I've always believed in female entrepreneurship. So when I wrote my book, I actually realized that what I was using in starting a business was a lot of the feminine qualities, because I could really be me starting a business, like whereby when I was a lawyer, it was like Sahar putting the work face on. And a lot of the qualities that I needed to use, like back in my personal life, you know, the resourcefulness, the networking, the chattiness, the fact that I loved, you know, having a coffee and a cake, you know, I mean, the fact that I'm a shopaholic, the fact that I love brands. And I was sort of using all these qualities, which are kind of, you know, inherently like feminine qualities in what I was doing. So I actually realized that entrepreneurship suits women particularly. So I was always in the back of my head, I'd done so
I love it rather than suits women occasionally.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. It's because the feminine qualities, like genuinely, which I think qualities that used to almost make us the butt of jokes, right? Like that we used to have to hide in the workplace. So, you know, for example, multitasking, right? So, I mean, I got married quite late. So I never lived in a man with a man until I was 40. And I really honestly realized what they mean about women multitasking. Because when men do one thing, if they can only do one thing, literally. I mean, my husband, I mean, if he's like making scrambled eggs, it's like he's sort of spitting the human genome. Like, it's like one thing. And you can't disturb him while he's doing that. Whereas bless women, you know, they can do a million things. So multitasking is huge. The fact that women are chatty, you know, it's all about networking. Our softness, we used to have to kind of keep our softness. Whereas softness is all about empathy and emotional empathy, which is why, you know, everyone needs. So all this kind of vulnerability, all these qualities are qualities that really... So anyway, I thought women are just incredible for entrepreneurship. They're almost like the sort of untapped advantage in entrepreneurship. How can I relay this? But it was just always like in the back burner thinking, you know, the books didn't come about. And again, through COVID, you know, suddenly everything quietens down. So I'm free, you know, so that sort of freeness suddenly lets you think. And I remember I'd actually, not to share too much information, but I had a bunion operation. So I'm sitting there, like literally was sort of stuck at home. And I am going through my Twitter feed and I sort of have time to look through it properly. And I see this tweet and the tweet said, not all of us can invest in women. Not all of us can mentor women, but we can all buy from them. And I kind of thought, you know, that's, and then it was like hashtag play your part. I remember calling the person that did the tweet and I said, that was really powerful what you just put because it's so true. And then I realized that I know a lot of the brands that women built because I'm in the ecosystem and I judge all the awards and stuff. But the average consumer doesn't know that we are surrounded by all these brands that actually women have built. And we don't know that. And what greater to create that connection and to almost bring sort of a sense of community, activism, solidarity into the buying process.
And now we have highlights from our interview with Joanna Jensen, founder of Child's Farm.
We are suckers for a solutions story here at The Midult. A grown-up woman who had a problem and thought, you know what? I'm not going to wait for some fucker to fix it. I'm just going to do it myself. This is true of today's guest. Joanna Jensen suffered from eczema as a child, and when her own children were born with the same condition, she decided enough is enough. In 2010, she created Child's Farm from her kitchen table. And by the end of the decade, it was the UK's number one baby and child brand. She sold it to Cussons for £37 million last year. Afraid we should all do a little dance right now. Anyway, it might sound like an enviably smooth ride, but like all of these stories, it is full of bumps, lumps, divorced, undiagnosed menopause and other crisis. Now, we are delighted to have Joanna here today. Joanna, how are you?
I'm absolutely fine, thank you, Emily. However, I had a dodgy manicure. And the result of this dodgy manicure means I have got five very stunted fingernails on each hand because I was given a fungal infection on every single hand. And as my GP said to me, oh, I've never seen anything quite so bad in my life, which was about, you know, okay, thanks, that's making me feel even better. So I am now, having been so proud of my beautiful nails, because I always had such beautiful nails, I now have these little stunted things, which the nails are crumbling, and there's a sort of bit of very dry and sort of yucky looking skin. And the moral of this story is if you go and have a manicure, make sure that they open all the bits and bobs in front of you, that, so you know they're sterilised, and bring your own nail file. Because what I was told is it, clearly it went from nail to nail to nail to nail. I can't tell you, it's utterly revolting. And I can't even pick my nose. I mean,
no,
that's how bad it is.
That's a tragedy.
Seriously.
So hang on. So you can get an infection from a, not even from one of the sharpie, pointy, scary things, but from a nail file.
Yeah, because if you think about it, if somebody's had a, you know, I mean, this is sort of fungus the bogeyman type, bleh. Infection. You go from one nail to the next nail to the next nail to the next nail, and you know what it's like, you chit-chat. Oh, where are you going on holiday this year, Annabelle? Oh, well, you know, that kind of thing. Or, oh, Emily, gosh, interesting shoe wear.
Are you okay?
These conversations. Are you okay? And you're chit-chatting, you're on your phone, you're miles away, and then the next thing you know, you think, gosh, aren't they pretty in painters? And then the next thing you know, your nails are lifting. And I never thought it would happen to me.
Does it hurt?
No, it just looks gopping.
And will they ever grow back?
Well, I've got to stop Googling it because some of them say your nails will grow back, but they'll never be the same.
Oh, stop it. Also, the worst thing is that, you know, like we talk so much about the kind of sort of little indignities, but when you're actually going to get a manicure, you feel like that's one of the moments where you're actually put together.
Completely.
I always look at people with manicures and think, you fucker, you've got, no one's stopping you in the street and saying, are you okay?
I agree. It looks like a sign of sort of robust time management and mental health in some way.
Exactly.
A decent manicure is a power tool.
Yes.
You know, you can do anything, but you swoop in with those glossy nails and, oh my God, boss bitch.
Well, speaking of boss bitch, Joanna
Let's
Jensen.
Let's hear it.
I mean, so it sounds as though you had a little girl with very painful eczema that you'd also been through as a child. In fact, hadn't your mother brewed up lotions and potions to try and help you?
Yeah, well, mum was, even though mum worked for the NHS, she was a bit of a sort of wacky backy child. And she was a great believer in natural medicine. And so everything that we had, from rose hip cough syrup to when we had a cold, she used to rub the soles of our feet with cloves of garlic and then hang it above the bed. Just thinking about it now, it's a little fucked up, isn't it?
But the vampires are coming, but anyway.
Sleep well, darling.
See you in the morning. So she was always using really wonderfully soothing natural shea butter, cocoa butter on our skin, because the Egyptians used that thousands of years ago. And having recently been to Egypt, I mean, they seemed to do everything well before we were still dribbling whilst they were sort of building the most amazing pyramids and gold chairs. And yeah, so she always encouraged us to go natural. We went to the homeopath if we felt poorly, you know, Bach rescue remedy. I think she drank quite a lot of that. It's only recently I discovered how much alcohol is in it. But, you know, just a quick squirt. You know, it was a sort of natural way of doing things. And it was so shocking when little Bells turned up in 2008 with really bad eczema. Nothing had moved on since I'd been a wee bairn in the 70s. And it was all sort of emollients and steroid cream. And I looked at my perfectly formed little child and I thought, I'm not going to slap that on you. So decided in a fit of pique to come up with my own formulas.
So you were working in banking at the time, is that right?
Yeah, well, actually, I had given up banking with the birth of my first child. And I was doing all sorts of odds and sods. I was breeding horses. We had this sillily big house, which actually cost an arm and a leg. I mean, every time you turn the heating on, it sort of inhaled about £2 million. So I was sort of running the house as a B&B. I was doing weddings there. I mean, honestly, it was a bit like Fawlty Towers. And, you know, my poor ex-husband, here's a clue, used to come home at the end of the week and I'd say, I've rented out our bedroom. You can't go there. We're in the cottage and therefore, so we're on a put you up. And so he weirdly used to spend less and less time coming home. But it was, we'd had a sort of tricky financial time. So it was just, I then decided, right, you know, actually, if I can create something for my kid that works, it's going to work for other people's kids. And bang, bang, bang. And then the next thing I know, this sort of tidal wave of everything happened.
There is something, isn't there, about being your own first customer?
Oh, God, yeah. Do you know, interestingly enough, and this is this little group that Sahar Hashimi has set up, the By Women Built, which is just a phenomena. She asked every woman, and there's about 400 of them, why did you set up your business? And these are all consumer brands. 99% of them are saying it's because there was a need. There was something they needed and they couldn't find. So they set something up. Their brands were created for their own personal need. And that's exactly what I did. And I just couldn't believe that no one had done this, but it was a really dusty category. Baby and child was dominated by Johnson's Baby and, you know, Baby Dove and Matey.
I suppose when you're starting a business, you know, from the proverbial kitchen table, what makes you think that you can? I mean, so many of us are so plagued with, oh no, it's other people that start business. They're called entrepreneurs. It couldn't possibly be me.
Oh, blind faith. And I think we all suffer from imposter syndrome, which is such a silly, silly name, isn't it? It's a silly label. It's just we all sort of randomly, and I don't know whether this is because we're British or what, but we just all sort of think, oh, no, I couldn't possibly do it. Oh, no, that's what other people do, that sort of thing. But other people go to the loo too. You know, it's this kind of, my mother always used to say this sort of, even the Queen has a poo, darling. I don't know what it is. And yet Beyonce launches something and everyone goes, oh, gosh, she's so brilliant. Oh, God, that's going to be a wonderful success. But one of us does it. And you know that everyone's slyly saying behind their hand, oh, it'll be a disaster. She won't make a penny out of it. Never mind, bless her. Let's just sort of be very supportive openly. I don't know why we're not like that. I think we are, you know, inability to say that we're good at something is part of it. You know, we need to dial up our inner Americans. I mean, you know, they seem to be fearless and capable of doing absolutely anything because they've got this mindset, which is, I believe in me. And it's like that wonderful thing that when, unless you love yourself, how are you going to know how to love somebody else? And so it's one of those things, I believe in me. And I think, frankly, I was so strapped for cash. I had two small children. You know, life was just a little bit fraught. I never saw my husband, which is sort of quite understandable when there was never a bed for him. But, you know, all of these things manifested themselves. And I grasped at this olive branch and I thought, I can do this and I'm going to make this so. And then because I am a woman who is very proud and, you know, my ex-husband said to me when I was looking at cowshed stuff, I said, why don't they do this for kids? And he said, well, if you think you can do a better job, do it yourself. Well, I mean, you know, that was immediately I flicked a V-sign at him and I thought, well, fuck you. Yes, I will, actually. Thank you very much. And part of my drive is people doubting me and I want to prove them wrong, which is pathetic. It's so pathetic. But what it should be is my belief in myself. But, you know, you're outwardly you're so, oh, everyone says, God, you're so confident. She's so, yeah, wow, she's just, oh, go, go, go. And then I'll sort of go back into my little closet and just go, oh, fuck, that was quite frightening. But I've got better at it now because I actually do kind of believe I can do stuff. But then I just giggle behind my hand thinking, yeah, no, it's all, well, wake up in a minute and it'll all be a load of old nonsense and just be rubbish. Do you know, one of my oldest friends is that lovely author, Charlie McAsey. And when it all gets too much for him, he goes and hides in the loo. And I don't do that. And so I actually benchmark myself against that and think, I haven't had to hide in the loo.
Yes.
Is that a positive thing? Yeah.
For now.
No loo hiding.
As Annabelle would say.
Yes.
But so it sounds like a good old-fashioned sort of rage to riches story. But what was... it wasn't easy, though. It hasn't been easy.
I seem to get the impression that you, as you were building your business, everything else sort of fell apart. I mean, your marriage fell apart. You lost that big house, I think. Is that right? And then you had some illness to deal with. Do you want to just talk us through how that stuff all exploded at once?
I actually had to laugh at myself about this because I think I sound like a sort of kind of, you know, everything went to hell in a handbasket. And yet, you know, it sounds sort of like a cheesy novel. But I mean, I had, my marriage was not great. We got divorced. In the process of that, we actually lost the house and I had enough money to pay the rent on our home for a year with two small girls living with me. And I then very quickly, the year I got divorced, actually, I was actually in, my husband took me to court, which was sweet. and I was in the courtroom and I just thought, do you know, I'm in so much pain. This has got to stop. I've got to go and see a doctor. But, you know, it's the last thing you think about. I was trying to raise money. We just launched in Boots. We just launched in Waitrose. I was just trying to sign up some new investors. It was all happening. And then the next thing I know, I'm in hospital having a 2-kilo tumour removed, which was actually a fibroid that grew out of my womb. I mean, get the sick bucket out. Grew out of my womb and it wrapped itself around my intestines and my appendix. And because I was busy and because I was busy, I didn't do anything about it until I literally couldn't walk. I was in so much pain.
I mean, there's quite a lot of stuff, isn't there, in the press about neither women nor doctors taking female pain seriously. I mean, how much pain must you have been in and for how long?
It must have been for about 6-8 months. When I got to the gynaecologist who removed it, he said that was one of the most frightening operations I've ever done. You probably had about 10 days and that thing would have burst. And if you'd have gone to A&E, they'd have taken everything out. So it would have been colostomy bag and urostomy bag and, you know, not. And I think I was, what, 44 at the time, which is not, you know, how you want to live your life. And he said, but knowing you, you'd have taken 2 paracetamol and gone to bed and you just wouldn't have woken up.
So you're building this brand and you've got investors, you know, chasing you. You've got retailers chasing you. You've got internal stakeholders chasing you. And you have to find the time to be ill.
Yeah, I mean, I do recall doing the final draft agreements for our shareholders' agreements on my hospital bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, because I thought, if I don't do it now, I'm not sure when I will get it done. And my word, do you know, my worst challenge about that, and the only time I think I can remember feeling sorry for myself in a very long time, was when I didn't know who was going to pick me up, because when I'd gone in for the tumour operation, he said, oh, it's going to be easy peasy, be in and out in a day. And of course I wasn't, and I was there for about 3 days. And I just thought, my children were at home, and I thought, who's going to pick me up?
Mm.
And then I felt really sorry for myself, and I thought, yeah. Christ, because I'm not one of those people that would phone somebody up and say, do you mind picking me up from London and driving me down Hampshire? And it wasn't that I didn't have friends, it's that I just didn't want to impose on anyone.
Yeah, we do that.
And that's pathetic too. I was at a thing with a load of Ukrainian refugee women this week, and one great friend of mine who's Ukrainian said to them all, you must ask for help because the English is so bad about it, but if somebody asks somebody who's British for help, they will inevitably get it. But we are totally crap about asking for help, particularly mums, I think, because we don't want to be judged as being... You know, I didn't want to be judged as a woman who's, oh, well, you see, she's running her own business and she doesn't have time for children. And of course, there's nobody to pick her up from hospital because she's so busy and she always blanks us in the car park at the playground or whatever. And it's because my mind is thinking, shit, shall I have that in blue or pink? And isn't that the right fragrance? And Christ, I haven't phoned the buyer back from Tesco's. And so it's all kind of, you know, I just internally, I was just thinking, I'm so inadequate. I'm so being judged by everyone. You know, so that was my moment of self-pity, I suppose. And then when I got their first offer, which was to buy it, I was in America at our distributors there. And I took myself off with actually poor Scott. And I just burst into tears and I said, I don't think I'm ready to sell my business. And then actually, because I'm quite commercial, I thought, actually, you fucking are. God, think of the cash. at the same time, you know, I had not real pressure from my shareholders, but some of them had been with me for, you know, 9 years. I had my girls, I had my mum, and, you know, the only thing that I worried about was my staff. That's all I worried about, because I know I probably didn't show it, but I cared more about them than they will ever know. And the sleepless nights I had when we were short of cash about how I was going to pay them.
What were the really big surprises about building a business, it turning out to be very successful, selling it for a load of money? What were the surprises to you at the other end, as it were?
Do you know, all the way through, the biggest surprise the whole way through is what people used to say about the products. And we would have, you know, in the olden days when we had a answer machine, I would listen to messages when I came in the morning and people would phone up and say, we just wanted to leave you some feedback about your baby moisturiser. You know, we saw it in the Daily Mail and we thought we'd get some. And I tried it on my daughter and she's had chronic eczema for the last 7 years. And within 24 hours, her skin has cured and it's amazing. And I don't know what to say. And I'm sorry I'm crying, but it's so emotional. And I would sit there in tears.
Yeah, I'm nearly in tears.
And when the chap phoned me up and I would always take the calls and he phoned me up and he said, I've got to tell you, I've had really bad psoriasis on my hands for many, many years. And last night I went to the pub and I put my hand in someone else's crisp packet to have a crisp. And it's the first time I've been able to do that pretty much all my life, because normally a bit of my skin would fall off. But since I've used your baby moisturiser...
I can steal crisps with impunity. The things that you have achieved, Joanna.
Yeah, but that, do you know, that makes me proud. It makes
me so proud.
Helping people. I want to go to my little old lady's rocking chair and say, I've done something. I've done something that's actually helped people.
That was a hell of a story, wasn't it? Anyway, normal service should resume soon. But thank you so much for listening, and I hope you are all absolutely fine.
You've been listening to Annabel Rifkin and Emily McMeekin of The Midult. Our book, I'm Absolutely Fine, is out now. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and subscribe.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.